Well, tonight we've got investigative journalist Jim Marrs joining us this hour, along with Doug Horn, author of Inside the Assassination Records Review Board, the U.S. government's final attempt to reconcile the conflicting medical evidence in the assassination of JFK. Hard to believe this story occurred 46 years ago.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please. Put me on, Phil. Put me on.
I think all of us who remember that day lost a little something that moment that we've never been able to find again. Maybe one day we will, but we haven't. In a moment, we'll talk with Jim Marrs and with Mr. Horn about this story on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, two guests for you this hour. Jim Marrs, award-winning journalist, has more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. And you know him. He's a regular guest here on Coast to Coast. Matter of fact, Jim will be with Ian Punnett, full show on December 19th, to discuss his new novel, The Sisterhood of the Rose. Here's Jim Marrs. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Hey, George. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Likewise. And Doug Horn, of course, graduated cum laude from the Ohio State University in 1974 with a BA in history. He worked for the Navy for 20 years in various capacities prior to assuming his position on the staff of the Assassination Records Review Board in 1995. Doug served on active duty in the Navy as a junior officer for 10 years, achieving professional qualification as a surface warfare officer in 76, now works for the State Department. Here he is. Hey, Doug, how are you?
Just fine, George. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
9 years Navy for me, so I didn't quite get as many years in as you did, Doug, but I had a great time doing it.
Understand, so did I.
Tell me a little bit about the Records Review Board, Doug.
Well, the JFK Records Act of 1992 is the response to Oliver Stone's movie JFK. The public became aware as a result of the film that many federal and congressional records were still being withheld on that subject. So the act required that agencies look for and release records. And the review board was an independent federal agency created by the JFK Records Act to look at those records which agencies did not want to release in full. In other words, only a small proportion of the records found by agencies were released in full and turned over to the archives. Most agencies wanted to withhold entire documents or portions of those documents. So the review board, its charter was to review the proposed redactions and decide whether they would be released or not.
All right, Jim Marrs, tell us a little bit about your relationship with Doug Horn here.
Well, I was aware of Doug when he was doing his work on the Assassination Records Review Board, and I haven't been in very close contact with him since, but when I understood that he was coming out with this new volumes of books, and I began to find out what he's saying, then I was really excited because, as a newspaper man, back in the 60s, I was trying to tell people there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, and it occurred at the highest levels of the federal government of the United States. And, of course, I was just a conspiracy buff, you know. But as all the years rolled by, we're finding out more and more and more. And as far as I know, Doug Horn is probably the first official who has actually dealt with primary evidence and has had access to the things that the public cannot even see, who is now coming out and saying exactly what I said back in the 60s, that there's been fabrication of evidence and destruction of evidence and suppression of evidence, and all this is, of course, taking place not by Russians, not by anti-Castro Cubans, and not by mafia figures, but within our own government.
Tell us a little bit about this evidence that might have been tampered with, Doug.
Sure. I have found six different areas where I believe there's fraud in the evidence. And before I briefly detail what those are, I liken the Kennedy assassination to a 500-piece picture puzzle in which in late 1963, somebody threw away half of the pieces and added 250 other pieces that were from the wrong picture. So,
great analogy.
Right. So the problem is that researchers who have been assuming that all the evidence held by the government was untainted and authentic have been engaged in a hopeless task trying to make sense out of all these puzzle pieces where half of them are from the wrong puzzle. So my unalterable conclusion after working for the review board for 3 years and swimming in that sea is that there's been a government cover-up of the medical evidence, and I find fraud in six specific areas, which I'll cover very briefly here.
Sure. And what would the reason be for covering up the medical evidence?
Well, the real question is the official story true? Was the president shot by
a lone gunman?
By a lone gunman in a building? Was it an act of chance, an historical quirk of fate with no political significance, or was he killed by a crossfire? If he's killed by a crossfire, it's clearly a conspiracy, and then you move on from there to the big questions of who and why. So the medical evidence is the key to understanding what happened in Dealey Plaza, and if you conclude that it's been covered up, then you've got a serious problem.
Absolutely. And in order to, let's say, cover up a crossfire, you would then have to hide some portions of this medical evidence, photographs or what have you, I would guess.
Right, and that leads us into the first area of fraud in the evidence. It's a fact that numerous autopsy photographs and two skull x-rays have been destroyed. I mean, that cannot be challenged. Depending on which, how much weight you give to different eyewitness testimony and sworn testimony, at least 10 and possibly 18 different views of the body of the president that should be in the official collection are missing. They're not there.
We don't know who took them or who destroyed them, I take it.
We don't know who destroyed them. We know who took them. The review board deposed the two official photographers, but they're not there. The photos are not there.
George,
yes,
in support of this, we know who took the photographs and who took the x-rays. Floyd Reby took photographs at the autopsy, and Gerald Custer took the x-rays, and both of those men, these are not conspiracy theorists, and they're not people trying to sell a book. These are the people who took the x-rays and took the photographs, and they are now on the public record saying that the x-rays and the photographs that the government is showing us today, that so many people like Vincent Bugliosi are basing their books and basing their conclusions on, mm-hmm. are not the ones they took.
Uh-huh.
Right, Doug?
Oh, that's correct.
What do you think, Doug, these photographs, the ones that were destroyed, showed?
I can tell you what the missing photographs would have depicted. Some would have depicted probes in the body, metal probes depicting bullet tracks in the body. We have one physician on duty that night who remembers seeing the flashbulbs go off, the strobe lights, as the photos were taken of probes in the body. And none of those are in the collection. And we have another a photographer who remembers developing some of those images. They're not in the collection. Other photographs missing are of the exterior of the entrance wound in the head and the interior of the entrance wound in the head. Another photograph that's missing is of the bruise on top of the right lung. Other photographs missing would include a large exit wound in the back of President Kennedy's skull. Those photographs are not in the collection, and yet many people remember them being taken.
I remember, I was 13 years old, Doug, but I remember they talked about how he was shot from the back, but his head went back. And I always found that to be weird. I always thought, If you're shot in the back with that kind of force, your head goes forward, not backward. If it went backward, you had to have been shot from the front.
It's a law of physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Right, yes. And another word for that is the law of conservation of momentum. If you're shot from the front once or twice, the force of that impact is going to carry you to the rear. That's simple.
What other areas here of evidence? Because you've
well, George, the three surviving skull X-rays are all they all appear to be forgeries. There are composite copy films. In other words, they do represent JFK's skull, but they're not the original X-ray. They're copy films, and the images have been altered. Two of those X-rays have had the image altered to mask or hide the blowout in the back of the head, and one of them has had a an apparent bullet fragment, which just happens to be 6.5 millimeters wide, added to the image. So we've got a radiologist, Dr. Mantic, who's not only an MD but a PhD in physics, who has done optical densitometry studies of those X-rays in the archives. He did this over a period of several years in the 1990s. And he's proven to my satisfaction with empirical data, with numerical data that can be repeated by others, that these three skull X-rays are forgeries. And I explain all that in my book so that anyone can understand it.
Would the kill shot, Doug, had come from the front, you think?
Yes, sir, from the right front.
All right, which would have been maybe the grassy knoll?
Yes, somewhere in that area. I define the grassy knoll as anywhere from the corner of the fence, which was near the car, all the way back to the overpass. So that's a large area, but it's to the right front.
And, Jim, when you talk about crossfire, and in your book called Crossfire, are we talking about a triangular shoot generally all at the same time?
Yes. The witnesses in Dealey Plaza vary significantly as to where the shots came from and to the number. The acoustical studies testified to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that there was as many as 10 sounds on that police dictabelt that they could not rule out as being gunshots. But since they only test fired from two locations, the infamous grassy knoll and, of course, the sixth floor from the school book depository, they were only able to say with some certainty that two shots came from the book depository, and at least one came from the grassy knoll.
Doug, what about the Zapruder film? Any work on that?
Oh, yes, sir. I'm proud to say that there's a very long chapter in my book. It's almost 200 pages long. It's almost book length, and I have presented what I believe is the strongest case yet presented that the film has been altered. Now I started out decades ago, like almost everyone else, assuming that the Zapruder film was an authentic film.
Sure.
And I've changed my mind since that time, specifically in the last 10 years. Now, when I was on the review board staff, I'm the one that requested that we do an authenticity study of the film. We knew the government was going to take it, and the review board did take the film legally to preserve it and to keep it in the archives. And so I said, let's do an authenticity study. So Kodak volunteered to do pro bono work for the review board, and they pulled a guy out of retirement, Mr. Zavada, and he conducted a limited authenticity study of the film. He did not study the image content. He studied things like edge print and other characteristics. And his report was delivered literally, 3 days before the review board shut down. So I didn't have a chance to review this thing in detail until a couple of years ago. And in my view, his report raises more questions than it answers. It's a very complex subject, and I'll let people read about it in the book, but it raises more questions than it answers.
But basically, Doug, what portion of that film, if we all remember it,
right,
might have been altered, and in what way?
And this is what's new in my chapter. It's clear to me that the exit wound in the rear of President Kennedy's head has been blacked out to hide it, and that a false wound has been painted on the right front of the head. Now, I believe I've laid forth the explanation of how this was done, too, using 1963 technology. The technique was almost certainly called aerial imaging, using an optical printer. It was one of the two methods commonly used for visual effects in the motion picture industry, And the news story here, I'm going to give you a scoop. No one else has this yet. The news story here is that for the first time, someone interested in this case has taken a copy of the Zapruder film, a copy obtained from the National Archives, so its provenance cannot be questioned. And they've shown it to experts within the Hollywood film industry. For the first time, this has been done. And a panel which examined high-definition scans of individual frames of the film just this past August unanimously decided, all three members of the panel unanimously decided that the film has not only been altered, but that it's a very poor alteration.
My, oh my.
Now, since that time, four additional experts have come forward independently, you know, one at a time, and said they concur. So we've got seven people now in the Hollywood film industry that say the film's not only altered, but it's a very bad job. And
did anybody, Doug, ever talk about the driver shooting the president?
Didn't happen.
Okay.
That's a very controversial subject. That's probably, we don't have time to go into that tonight. But not only is the back of the head blacked out in these frames, but there are serious chain of custody problems with how the film was handled the very weekend of the assassination. And I bring out that story to its full extent for the first time in my chapter. The government had its hands all over the film all weekend, right after President Kennedy was killed, both the Secret Service and the CIA. And it's my conclusion that that the film was altered at a CIA photo lab at Kodak headquarters in Rochester, New York.
And back in 63, probably.
Yeah, the weekend following the assassination. And I didn't pull this tail out of thin air. This is the right testimony of people who worked for the CIA.
Isn't it true that the government, the CIA, the National Photographic Interpretation Center of the CIA, had the film the night of the assassination?
Well, the following night, Jim, you're
following
close.
Night, okay.
It's
that awesome weekend, anyway.
Right. Here's what I've concluded in a nutshell. I'll simplify it for your audience.
Okay, sure thing.
The night after the assassination on Saturday, the original film, which was developed in Dallas on Friday, the day of the assassination, the original film, 8mm film, was examined at the CIA's Photo Analysis Center in D.C., in Washington, D.C., Saturday night, and briefing boards were made of the unaltered film by, you know, blowing up individual frames to create prints and then mounting those prints on poster boards. The very next night, 24 hours later, late Sunday night, another Zapruder film was delivered to the same National Photo Interpretation Center in Washington, D.C., except this one wasn't 8mm wide, it was 16mm wide. And the courier who brought it, the Secret Service courier who brought it, said, well, yeah, this is the original film, and it was developed in Rochester at such and such a lab. And he gave the code word for the secret lab. And if that isn't bad enough, the work crew that was called in the second night to make a second set of briefing boards was a completely different group of people. This was a compartmentalized operation. So you had Group A dealing with the real film Saturday night after the assassination, making briefing boards. Then you had a completely different group of people, Group B, at event number two, making briefing boards the next night from what clearly was an altered film. So the chain of custody doesn't hold up, and the images don't hold up now when they're examined by experts in the film industry. And by the way, that effort is ongoing and is continuing. And right now we have a strong consensus, and we're hopefully working towards scientific proof.
This was a coup, Doug, wasn't it?
Well, I believe it was. I believe our country had a coup in 1963. It doesn't make me happy to say that, but I believe President Kennedy, his foreign policy was feared and despised by the majority of the national security establishment, by the majority of his government. This man wanted to end the Cold War, not win it. And these people that cast a veto on his life did not want him reelected to a second term because they feared he would make unalterable changes in the world
order. Let's talk about who those people might have been, this cabal on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, you can pick up the After Dark News magazine by calling 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online and pick up the full color magazine at coasttocoastam.com. On our next Coast to Coast program, L.A. Marzulli joins us. Lynn, the alien interviews, conversations with people who experience UFO contacts. We'll be back in a moment, though, with Doug Horn and Jim Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Mars, do you and Doug agree on the cabal, who they might be?
Well, I'm not real sure because I haven't really talked in detail with Doug about that. But let me give you a cast of characters that was in Dallas the night before the Kennedy assassination. Richard M. Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover, George Herbert Walker Bush. Need I go on?
Okay, but would it be unusual because the president was there?
Well, no, that's not. I don't know, Doug. Do you think that's unusual to have that many top leaders in one place?
I'd like to answer George's question from another tangent, if I can. You know, in 1961, and then I'll get back to specifics, I promise.
Okay.
In 1961, President Kennedy received horrible advice from the military. They wanted him to send combat troops to Laos and use nuclear weapons if necessary to stop the communists.
Yeah.
They wanted him to send combat troops to Vietnam after he refused to send combat troops to Laos. And they expected him to bail out this ridiculous Bay of Pigs exile invasion when it failed, and he refused. He made it clear before the Bay of Pigs exile invasion that U.S. military forces would not be used, but the CIA and the military really thought they could sucker him into it, and it didn't work.
And they went ahead with it thinking maybe they could talk him into it,
right.
But he never did it.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff knew that the thing had almost no chance of success, and they did not tell the president. In fact, they lied to him. So this got worse in 1962. The Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended numerous pretexts, excuses, false excuses, to invade Cuba early in 1962. They were rejected by the president. Then they just said to heck with the pretexts. And 1 year after the Bay of Pigs, in April 62, the Joint Chiefs of Staff wrote a blistering ultimatum, really, to Secretary of Defense McNamara, demanding that the United States just unilaterally invade Cuba to get rid of the Castro regime. And to heck with the pretexts, we're just going to do it because it's in our national interest. And then they said, oh, by the way, we think we can do this without risk of general war, which was the politically correct code word for nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Let's just do it, they said. So these things were all rejected by the president. And then when President Kennedy opted not to invade during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but to resolve the crisis through diplomacy, that was it for these people. They said, this guy's got to go.
Now they had enough, didn't they?
They'd had enough. Now, this was exacerbated by his decision in 1963 to pull out of Vietnam by the end of 1965. And, you know, records unearthed by the review board confirm this as a fact. It's not just a hypothesis anymore. It's a fact. So the deep backstory to all this is that during the 1950s, there was a genocidal mentality that was pervasive within the American armed forces. And that was that we should launch a preemptive first strike against the Soviet Union and obliterate that country, and along with it, all other communist nations, before they could do the same to us. And this was recommended to President Eisenhower by people like Curtis LeMay and high-level civilians in the government.
Could be one of the reasons why, upon his departure, President Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex.
It certainly is. He rejected that recommendation in 54, I believe it was. Now, these people, this same group of people recommended this twice to President Kennedy. In 1961 and in 1963, they recommended that he conduct the first strike against the Soviet Union. The first time they did it, he walked out of the meeting in disgust. And the second time they did it in 63, he was prepared. And then he had a running argument for 2 hours with these people and told them that this wasn't going to be our policy. So it was in this climate of mutual contempt and mistrust that President Kennedy was killed. And I truly do believe that it was a consensus decision by the hawks within the national security establishment. Now, there were all kinds of people who wanted to, for example, conduct a first strike on the Soviet Union. Curtis LeMay, the head of the Air Force, the head of SAC, General Thomas Power, Paul Nitze, the leading hawk, the leading civilian hawk in the government, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Roswell Gilpatrick, was in favor of that during the missile crisis. A lot of people felt this way. So, and what they saw was a closing window of opportunity. They knew that the Soviet Union was building up its arsenal, and that within a few years, by the mid-60s, certainly by the late-60s, they knew that the U.S. could not go to war, a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, without incurring unacceptable losses. So these people really wanted to do this
early.
before we lost the opportunity. Yeah. And, of course, if they couldn't do that, they certainly wanted a victory on the battlefield to make up for the frustration over the Korean stalemate in 1953. Right.
What role did Johnson have in this?
Well, I believe that Lyndon Johnson and Hoover both had foreknowledge of the assassination and helped to cover it up. I view them as enablers. I view them as critical enablers of the assassination, but not as the masterminds of the plot.
And recipients.
Obviously. Oh, certainly. If you look at cui bono, who benefited, those two individuals benefited more than anyone else.
Well, let me take it one step further. Under our legal system, George, if you kill somebody and I know about it, and maybe I had the gun and I don't tell about it, I'm considered an accessory after the fact, and I'm considered just as guilty as the person that pulled the trigger.
That's right, Jim.
So in the Kennedy assassination, Lyndon Johnson and his next-door neighbor buddy, J. Edgar Hoover, are guilty as accessories after the fact. Not because we can prove they ordered it or orchestrated it. I think Doug and I are in agreement that decision took place at even higher levels, but because it's fully documented now that they took actions to block any meaningful investigation into what really happened.
Now, let me ask you this, too. Why haven't any, I've always believed that there's been a conspiracy here. Well, how come we don't have any whistleblowers, Jim Mars?
Oh, well, we have. There's been whistleblowers all over the place. People have spoken out. There's even a fellow in Joliet today who claims that he pulled the trigger, and there's been no investigation. I don't know if it's absolutely true or not, but he's definitely connected to the Chicago mob and to the CIA. And he did not just voluntarily come forward. He was pointed out by a member of the FBI, and yet there's been no investigation. There's been all kinds of people talk, but when they do, there's always somebody to step forward and say, oh, no, that's not right, that's not right. The cover-up has never been in the classic sense that there's been no information. The cover-up has been an obfuscation. Let's just confuse the issue, muddy the water so much that everybody just argues over this and that, and how many gunmen and which direction it came from. And there's a lot of the researchers today that just can't seem to bring themselves to get out of Dealey Plaza.
But, yeah. And they killed off witnesses, did they not?
Absolutely. How many? We're not sure. There's always plausible deniability, but sure. When you look at the number and the spacing of it, in other words, right after the assassination, many people who were connected to Jack Ruby died mysteriously, and then it kind of tapered off. And then the Garrison investigation came, and people connected with that milieu, they died off mysteriously. And then the one I like is about 1977, there were like about seven top FBI officials, all of whom were subpoenaed to testify to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. They all died before they could testify. Where does coincidence leave off and conspiracy begin?
Right, George, the spin masters that are still trying to control public opinion in this case, about every 10 or 15 years, they trot out the old wine of the Warren Commission and put it in a new bottle. So, the two examples I can think of are Gerald Posner's book and Vince Bugliosi's book. Mm-hmm. And the public isn't buying it.
Well, didn't a congressional committee state years later that it was a conspiracy?
They did, and then they promptly shut down without being able to define it.
That's true, George. In fact, not to mention it, the last official version of the federal government of the United States is there was probably a conspiracy, and there was more than one person shooting Kennedy, but we don't know who that was, so it was still Lee Harvey Oswald's three shots from the book depository.
Do you think any of these people who were involved then, it's been 46 years, Are any of them alive today? Maybe.
No, I don't think so, George. Well, certainly none of the decision makers, let's put it that way.
Are all gone. None of the secondary or tertiary people. There may be still there may be a few, but the ones that are still alive, you would never be able to connect to the crime.
Let's take a few calls here. Let's go to Anonymous. I wonder why. Hi there.
Hi. One of my friends was dating LBJ's girlfriend, who he had set up as a University of Texas a full English professor. And he had had a bastard child with her. And this lady was an nymphomaniac. And so my friend was going down to visit her. And he said he visited her right after LBJ did. And LBJ told her that SOB Kennedy would never embarrass him again. And this was a week before the assassination. And my friend drove down from Dallas on the week of on the day of the assassination. I didn't have the radio on. He was just tooling down there to visit his friend. And when he got there, she was gone. They put her in the witness protection program, sold the house and everything. She was later found out in California with her son, and they both died of cancer after several years. So LBJ was in it right up to his nose.
Jim Mars, you've heard stories like this, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Many.
How about LBJ?
Oh, and you know what? The very day of the assassination, I was here. I partied in Dallas. I grew up in Fort Worth. I was going to school in Denton at North Texas University. And there were people the day of the assassination that were whispering, saying, Lyndon's got something to do with this.
Jeez, right away.
Right away. Well, they knew what kind of person he was, and they knew that, you know, what he was capable of.
Yeah, George, I'll make this brief, but you asked about whistleblowers and why hasn't they, people have talked. Some of the little people involved with the autopsy have said very significant things. The two FBI agents that the review board deposed both looked at the autopsy photos of the back of President Kennedy's head, which strangely show it to be completely intact in the photos, which is not what the treating physician saw in Dallas. They saw an exit wound in the back of his head, and they both said, no, they said, that's not what President Kennedy looked like at the autopsy. They said, no, there's something wrong with these photos. And one of them said it looks like a reconstruction of the skull, and the other one said, well, it looks like this has been doctored. And he says, I don't mean the photos have been doctored, I mean the head's been doctored. So we have two FBI agents, trained observers, who said under oath that these photos are not what the president looked like at the autopsy. The back of his head was not intact.
Uh-huh. Do you think the Secret Service was aware of the potential danger in Dallas?
Secret Service is guilty of security stripping in the motorcade.
Yes.
It's an ugly story. This is such an ugly story that I think it's why we'll never hear the truth from the government. People need to study the evidence and make up their own minds.
Did that presidential limousine indeed stop?
Well, let me put it this way, George, because I remember interviewing Senator Ralph Yarborough, who's riding beside Lyndon Johnson, and I asked him that same question. I said, did the motorcade come to an absolute stop? And I think he pretty well nailed it. He said, well, if you toss a ball into the air, at some point it stops going up and it starts going down. Did it stop?
Yeah.
Right. 52 different witnesses say the limousine came to a complete stop. Now, that's not shown on the Zapruder film, but I believe that the Zapruder film is altered, so that's probably been removed through frame excision. And you know, half of those witnesses are motorcycle cops. Now, those guys understand relative motion. They're trained to keep station on the car they're riding out
for. Absolutely, yeah.
And the other witnesses that said it stopped were the people abreast of the car on both sides.
Right. Gene Hill said it came to a stop.
Always remember, though, Oswell on television coming out saying, I'm a patsy. Remember that, Jim Mars?
Absolutely. And, you know, he didn't say, I'm innocent. He said, I'm a patsy, which means I've been set up to take the blame for this crime. And yet, in all the investigations, the House Select Committee, the Warren Commission, they never, ever even took a look to see if maybe he was telling the truth.
And, somebody looked at whether he was telling the truth, and that was George O'Toole. In 1975, he did a voice stress analysis study using the PSE machine on those statements by Oswald. And in every case where he said, I didn't shoot anybody, he was clearly telling the truth because there was no stress in his voice when he made those specific statements.
Exactly.
Next up, Rochester, New York, we go. Ron, take it away. Go ahead, Ronnie.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've been listening to your show, and even back on November 23rd, a lot of people have been speaking about the assassination. And I don't know if any of you know that there's a new book out that was written in, well, by two people, one who claims to be the guy who fired the headshot. He's in jail. I believe it's in Texas. His name that he's going under is Jimmy Files right now. He wrote the book with a woman called Pamela Ray, mm-hmm. Who I guess wrote to him in prison because she's a born-again Christian, and he's also, I guess, seen the light. Evidently, they tried to assassinate him. He's actually in jail, I believe, for a botched assassination attempt where he shot back at somebody who was trying to shoot him. But
well, he's in Joliet. He's not in Texas, and that was the fellow I was referring to earlier. And he's in jail for the rest of his life for shooting a policeman, and yet the facts of the case shows that he and a friend of his were curbed by an unmarked car and men in plain clothes who jumped out, and in Files claims they just opened fire on him, and he thinks it was a hit. They were trying to kill him.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. Let's go next to Tony, first-time caller. Go ahead, Tony.
Yes, hello. I was just wondering, because you know how he was saying, can you hear me? I'm on
yeah.
the road. Every time I pass through Amarillo, I listen to y'all on 710. But anyways, you know how he's saying all these photos were altered and everything like that? Could some of that stuff have been smoke and mirrors or no? Like, you know how they can do, like, you know, at that time, you know, make it seem like, well, we can make it seem like he really did. This really did happen, and all of a sudden, they probably did kill him. But was some of that smoke and mirrors? Because how did all of a sudden they caught
I'd like to address that. The autopsy photographs of the president's head wounds, I do not believe, are photographic alterations. The three skull x-rays are, but the autopsy photographs are not. I'll tell you what they are. Clandestine, illicit post-mortem surgery, not life-saving surgery, post-mortem surgery was performed on President Kennedy's cranium at Bethesda Naval Hospital before the autopsy started, in secret. And then the head was photographed, and the results of that surgery has been misportrayed as, quote, what the bullet did, unquote. That's what's wrong with two-thirds of the autopsy photos. Now, what's wrong with the others of the back of the head is that the scalp was simply rearranged. After the FBI agents left, the scalp was moved over to cover the exit wound. So they're not photographic alterations, but they are dishonest pictures.
Jim Mars, Doug Horn, thank you so much for giving us this information on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.